Welcome to this portion of Vocal Point. I'm Jerry Newcomb, and right now our guest is an expert on foreign policy, and we're going to talk about some developments overseas that have impact on America. And while we could talk about the Brexit story, we really do want to talk about Syria. Our guest is William Ogborn, and he's in Washington, D.C. He's got a lot of experience working for different departments, including the U.S. Department of State's Public Affairs and Public Diplomacy Official. He also used to work for House Speaker Denny Hastert and Majority Leader Dick Armey in terms of IT and public relations. And he worked on the campaigns of Dr. Ben Carson and Governor Scott Walker as well. William, great to have you on the program. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me this morning.
Sure. All right, let's get Brexit out of the way and then focus on Syria, because I think Syria is very important in the big picture of things when it comes to foreign affairs. So, first of all, why should Americans care about what's happening in England as far as, you know, the kind of the drama involving Theresa May and the Brexit and all that stuff?
Well, the first and foremost, it's going to affect the markets. So we're going to see a big impact, whether there's a hard Brexit, soft Brexit, whether there's no Brexit, if that were to happen. No matter what, this chaos and instability, markets hate that. So once a path forward is set, then the markets can kind of start to adjust. Different companies can start to figure out what their strategies will be. And also America will be figuring out what its strategy is going to be with dealing with trade with the UK, which can really help some U.S. industries, and it can really revitalize some U.K. industries as well.
So what happens in London has impact on Wall Street in America?
Yes, absolutely, especially because London is one of the financial centers of Europe and the world.
And just real fast, just to put this in perspective, England had a referendum, okay? And as I recall, it was even before our presidential election in November 2016. Same year, though, I think. And
yes.
Surprisingly, the people voted to go ahead and break with the European Union. And then Theresa May was the prime minister. How come that break with the EU has never kind of officially been accomplished, even though that's what the voters wanted, it seems?
Well, first and foremost, it's a long process because we're talking about a 45-year agreement between what became the EU and Britain. So they had a lot of engagements and a lot of entanglements that they had to have to figure out ways to disengage. And even, you know, you have the battle between the people that don't want to disengage at all, that only want partial disengagement, and then you have those folks that want a full engagement. So trying to navigate that space is what's taken the 2 years to have these votes on what the plan for Brexit is. And that's also why it's taken so long. It's just figuring out the way to do this.
Is Theresa May still the prime minister, and is she kind of a wounded prime minister in a sense?
She's definitely wounded. Yeah, you know, they had the no confidence vote the other day. She survived that. Corbyn is really gunning for her. The Labour Party wants to try and overthrow the Brexit vote. They want a new referendum. They want to take power and make sure that this doesn't happen. And the Brexiters are really Brexiters and Tories are both forced to really go behind May, even though she was a Remainer when the vote happened, because they have no other choice. The hardline Brexiters like Boris Johnson, they can't get into the prime ministership. They know that. So their only way is through Theresa. So she's just hanging by a thread, and if she doesn't seem to deliver the proper avenue for a Brexit, you know, you could see that government collapse, and you could see Labour actually taking power and forcing another referendum.
Okay, and the reason, again, this has impact on America is because of our markets. Okay, now let's shift gears and talk about Syria. Syria is has been going through a civil war for several years now. And by the way, I think it's very important to listen to what the Christians in Syria have to say, because they've been suffering through persecution. I mean, they existed in that country long before Muhammad was even born, and before the Islamic forces took over, you know, in the 600s sometime. So let's talk about Syria. And first of all, how about a quick comment about the civil war itself? Is this something that will end anytime soon?
I don't see it ending anytime soon because you still have those elements. You have a, it's like a 7-layer onion, if even that. It might be even more layers. And you have so many interested parties now in Syria because of the civil war. And you have different factions fighting each other that are Syrian-based. So you have the Kurds, you have Assad's forces, you have some other independent forces, you have ISIS. And then you have the outside militaries. You have Turkey, you have Saudi Arabia, you have Iran, you have Qatar, you have Russia, all involved in this area. So there's, it's not going to be simply if the U.S. were to totally destroy ISIS, let's say in just a hypothetical world, it's not going to solve the civil war in Syria. It's going to keep going on in some form or another for a while until somebody can exert full control over that area.
Now, some people have said that we will not rest until Bashar al-Assad is out of power. And yet, on the other hand, again, I go back to voices I've heard from Christian sources in Syria saying, we don't, you know, Assad's not perfect. He's terrible in some ways, but he's the better of the alternatives that we see, you know, that are there.
That's absolutely correct. The Christians are actually one of the main groups saying that we needed to put efforts behind supporting Assad because they had a very good relationship with Assad and he had protected them from extremist elements that were trying to eliminate them. So that really kind of went against American policy because, you know, with the previous administration, they did put that red line that we have to get Assad out. And it honestly, it was a policy that was never going to happen. That's like, you know, you can't, Russia couldn't go to us and say, we're going to get rid of Netanyahu and you can't stop us. And that's that same kind of thing. This is a longstanding ally of Russia. It's one of their warm water ports is based in Syria. So having that kind of hard line wasn't going to work. And it was also to the detriment of the Christians because it forced them to actually go against what our interests would have been.
And Syria is does have a Christian population that's sizable compared to some of the other Middle Eastern countries where the Christians have been liquidated, so sadly, so sad to say, or they've fled into, you know, the United States or Canada or other parts in the West. Okay, how about Syria and America's troops? I didn't even realize, you know, how much of a commitment do we even have there? And who first sent over the troops, Obama or was that President Trump?
No, the initial troops were sent over under Obama, and Trump basically took the leash off and let Mattis do what he needed to do instead of just simply having kind of a base there that was behind the lines and supporting some of the different groups. We also had competing factions of our own government. The DOD was working with one group of rebels. The CIA at one point was working with another group of rebels, and that was creating a whole lot of chaos on our end and their end. And so Trump kind of said, there's only going to be one group, we're going to do this, and we're going to fight this way. And so now we had about 2,000 troops that are based around Hasaka, and that's well behind the front lines of where the ISIS territory remains. And that's what we're looking to remove, just that 2,000, but not removing any of the platforms in the area, and that includes Turkey, Iraq, Jordan, Israel, Mediterranean-based, Gulf-based, Strait of Hormuz-based. So we have plenty of platforms still to strike ISIS, even if we leave.
Did President Trump act prematurely, in your opinion, when he announced about 3 or 4 weeks ago, okay, we're pulling out of Syria?
I wouldn't say that he acted prematurely. I would have cautioned against using language that we've totally destroyed ISIS. ISIS is more of an idea, and that idea is the caliphate, which isn't just contained by ISIS. Several different Islamic countries and leaders come and go through the years and even currently have the idea of the caliphate.
Yep.
That's hundreds of years old. You're never going to destroy that. But we have destroyed the command and control centers of ISIS. We've gotten them down to now where they're just simply sleeper cells. That's what we saw the attack the other day, or little splinter cells that we're going to continue to see those kind of bombings, those kind of activities, even once all that ungoverned territory is finally taken control by one of the powers that's in the area.
You know, just in talking with you, I realize I have lost track of al-Baghdadi. Is that man still alive? He was the assumed caliphate, right, according to the ISIS people?
He was. You know, right now I'm kind of blanking it. I feel like he was killed, but I couldn't tell you unless I Google searched.
Yeah,
really
no, it's just strange. You know, he certainly dropped off of the headlines. Let's put it that way. All right, now let me ask you this. Okay, just to put this in perspective, and this is a centuries-old conflict that goes back to at least the 600s. So, and Islam was born, you know, in the 600s, and Muhammad died in 632, and that's when all the invaders went out and so forth. Okay, the Sunnis represent about 85% approximately of Islam, and the Shiites represent about 15%. And the two groups have been fighting against each other, the Shiites versus the Sunnis and vice versa. Okay, now, the Iranians are Shiites, and it's my understanding that Assad is a branch of Shiites. Not fully in the same thing, but basically they're together. So Iran and Syria effectively are allies, correct? And how does that figure into all the conflicts going on in Syria?
Well, they're allies of convenience. Assad has his own desires and goals. He's much more secular than Iran is currently. So when they meet up in interests, and usually that will have to do with financial interests, then they'll work together. But Iran trying to come in and having desires to take over parts of their territory or having controlling interests in some of their people, Assad doesn't want that. He wants his people, his territory. He believes it's his birthright. So no one else, no matter if they're aligned politically, religiously, really is going to be an ally of his that he's going to invite in and let have sway.
When we saw the mass migration and attempted migration and so forth from the Middle East into Europe, for example, or also even into parts of America, were those people mainly fleeing Syria in particular?
We mainly saw them fleeing Syria. They were fleeing other parts, but it mainly did come from Syria. And then you had other people mixing in as well. So that's where you got some of those cells and the fears of terrorism threats getting through by offering any kind of blanket asylum. Because when you have such a mass migration, it then becomes so hard to control that easily people can mix in that are not the refugees and not the asylum seekers and not the folks that you want. And especially became a problem because we weren't seeing the families immigrating so much sometimes in those migrations. Yeah. It was just young men, and the young men are the ones that you're thinking, wait a second, why aren't they staying to fight?
Yeah.
That's what makes sense to us. So whereas we were very happy to be part of welcoming the women and children, and Europe especially was part of that, it really did give us pause to see so many young men doing it. And that's what created the tension of, like, are these all Syrians? Are they all just refugees? Is this legitimate?
Yeah, because, I mean, there is such a thing as a jihad through migration.
Yes.
Any comments on that?
So, yeah, when you have the migration, what you're doing is, you know, people can pretend to be whomever they want to be. There's who they say they are versus who they actually are. Everybody lies. So you can come in and be like, hey, I really just want to be a part of Germany, and I want to do this, and I want to do that, and I just want to make a life for my family. That doesn't mean that you put those behind. I mean, we know about spycraft. We know about how these other things work. So simply thinking this does not happen, or just a cursory glance and believing simply what somebody said, isn't enough to protect us from those elements. And those elements will always be there. And that's what our agencies and the groups that we work with NATO and European allies, they're always on the lookout for those kind of things, and they've done a fantastic job in protecting us from it.
Okay, we have about 30 seconds left. Any quick comment about border security in America in terms of we don't know who's coming from through Mexico trying to get into the United States, including some would-be terrorists?
I want to go back really quickly. Al-Baghdadi is dead.
Okay.
So, let you know there.
Good.
In terms of that, yes, it can be very hard to police that border at all times. Certainly you see a lot of mixing in. Is the terrorist threat like something that we're seeing hundreds of thousands of people coming across our border, they're terrorists? Of course not. But it only takes one.
Yeah.
And that's why we have to always be vigilant, because one incident is huge, and that kills lots of people. So we can't afford to make a mistake once. And that's what the terrorists have always counted on, is our letting our guard down, or them slipping through just one time.
Yep, 9/11, 19 men. 19.
Yep.
William Ogborn, thanks so much for being with us. Appreciate your insights.
Thank you very much for having me.